Honorable Court of Appeals of the State of New Mexico.
Good morning. Please be seated. Calling New Mexico Ethics Watch versus Legislative Counsel Service, cause number A1CA41767. Counsel, could I have your appearances, please?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Tom Nasco on behalf of the New Mexico Legislature and the New Mexico Legislative Counsel Service.
Thank you.
Daniel Yohalam on behalf of New Mexico Ethics Watch, appellee here.
Good morning, Counsel. Good morning. Thank you for coming to Albuquerque for our oral argument today. I do want to make you all aware of some new technology or newer technology we have in this court. So our oral argument today is being live streamed. Your microphones are live at all times. When you speak at the podium, the camera, just so you're aware, will go to the speaker. When we speak, it'll come over to us. So I just want you all to be aware of that technology. Counsel for the appellant, how much time have you reserved for reply?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
Great. All right. And please proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. This appeal seeks the reversal of district court order sanctioning an inappropriate request for legislative documents that preceded the enactment of the 2021 Supplemental Appropriations Act. And to set the table, Your Honors, this case originally revolved around five requests, IPRA requests for documents, three of which, numbers 1 through 3, concerned pre-enactment materials related to the General Appropriation Act, and number 5 related to the statewide capital outlay program legislation. Those requests were ultimately abandoned after we filed our motion for summary judgment, leaving request number 4, which deals with the 2021 Supplemental Appropriations Act. In my presentation today, Your Honors, I'd like to make clear initially what the 2021 Supplemental Appropriation Act is and the process for enacting it. Secondly, I'd like to discuss the district court's order and how that order violated Section 2-3-13, the legislative confidentiality statute, which protects from disclosure any materials that constitute a request for service, any pre-enactment type materials. It also violates the speech and debate clause under Article 4, Section 13, as per the Stewart case, because it is seeking materials that are integral to the legislative process. And in so doing, does severe damage to the independence of the legislative branch and the process of legislating. Finally, Your Honors, I would like to talk about how the district court got to this order. And I will take this, Your Honors, through that. It's very, very simple. It's an abuse of discretion because she applied incorrectly or ignored, I should say, the Uniform Statute and Rules Construction Act based on a subsequently enacted legislation that allowed for the disclosure of this type of material. Finally, Your Honor, I would like to comment when I conclude on the damage that has been done to the legislative process and how this runs afoul of the Stewart case and clearly violates the confidentiality statute, and that on a going forward basis, the legislature has no assurances that it can act independently and act without fear of outside interference in activities which precede the enactment of legislation. The process for the 2021 Supplemental Appropriation Act is unique, Your Honors, because that's been changed, and that's very important in this case. It was changed in 2022. But in 2021, here was the process.
As you describe the process, Counsel, can you make sure you connect what you're saying to the record that we have about the process? Because it does seem like there is some confusion in our record about exactly how this spreadsheet came to be and who the players are on all sides of it.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I'd be happy to do that. And we tried to make that clear through the affidavits of Amy Chavez Romero, who was the Assistant Director of the Legislative Counsel Service at the time. The affidavit of Raul Berciaio explained how the process occurred. Let me summarize that, if I may, because it's a very important question. Initially, Your Honor, the Supplemental Appropriations Act is an act whereby each individual legislator is assigned a certain amount of funding that he or she can recommend for disposition as he or she desires. It may be to a an executive agency, which is typical. It may be to some other recipient, which is also typical. And the process by that, Your Honor, and to answer Judge Ray's question directly, is once that information is compiled, it's drafted into a draft spreadsheet.
By whom?
The Legislative Council Service and the House Appropriations and Finance Committee, the staff. They get together and they draft this spreadsheet.
Together.
They all work together. And once the spreadsheet is drafted, it's very important because then it goes to the Legislative Council Service as a request for service under Section 2-3-13. And they conduct a lot of research. And here are the things they look at. They look at, number one, if a legislator's particular request for an appropriation can be accepted by the recipient. They look at that. Secondly, they look at, is it a duplicative request? And should the legislator know about that so he or she might change his or her request as a result?
Counsel, I'm sorry. I believe you're referencing to some extent Amy Chavez Romero's affidavit. It appeared perhaps that her affidavit was a bit unclear whether these steps that you're describing right now actually occurred with regard to the junior bill spreadsheet that you're describing. Am I misreading her affidavit, or is she stating that the steps you're indicating right now actually occurred here?
Your Honor, she stated the steps actually occurred. Okay. That she and Raul Burciaga as well. So the process is a fluid process. So those steps occur. Once the research occurs, legislators could change their mind. It goes back to the committee. The committee discusses and debates the spreadsheet. The committee makes recommendations on that spreadsheet. That can change. Then it goes to the leadership again and then to the floor of the House and the Senate. And it can change on the floor. But here's the interesting part, and this is where there might be a gap. The spreadsheet, the changes in the appropriation don't necessarily occur in the spreadsheet. They can occur all the way up to the adoption of the bill. And they can occur orally. There can be a phone call to the Legislative Council Service. A legislator could change his or her request, or leadership could say, we're not going to allocate money toward that particular project. That's their prerogative. So it's changed in the final bill.
So what you're describing, it sounds, as you say, very fluid, lots of input, lots of work is done based on the spreadsheet. But Mr. I keep forgetting his name, the testimony of Mr. Abbey seemed to suggest a sort of more cursory review. Or no review, maybe, done by LCS.
No, Your Honor, that's not what Mr. Abbey talked about. There is a lot of research done by LCS, particularly anti-donation research, to determine whether there's duplicative requests, to determine whether the agency or any the third party can accept that.
And I understand that that's what was said later, but I'm asking for help interpreting what it was that Mr. Abbey was saying, because it's not unreasonable to read it the way that Ethics Watch did, that this is really just they get what they want, I think is what he said.
You know, that's the implication from the other side, but that is not what happens.
So
I think that's what Mr. Abbey never testified that that's what happened. He testified that, yes, the spreadsheet goes to the committee, and the committee will forward that spreadsheet after debate to the House, to the floors, and it is still a work in progress all the way. We don't even know, and here's the reason why. In 2021, Your Honor, this is an excellent point. There is no way in 2021, there was no mechanism in the Supplemental Appropriations Act where one could take the act as chaptered, as enacted, and determine who made the appropriation or how much. And the reason by who is quite clear, because there's no indication in the final bill of any identification of any legislator. So that part is clear. But the second part is, if more than one legislator is assigning funds to a particular agency, an executive agency, that's just lumped together in the final act. There's no indication of which funding is which. And it changes all the way up through that process. So it stays a pre-enactment service, which is the important piece for this appellate court to consider, in my judgment, Your Honor. It stays as a pre-enactment service all the way up through passage of the bill. Now.
And is that why your brief refers to Rule 12-1? I sort of read it as 12-1 suggests that this is a group of people all working together to do the work of the legislature, and we don't need to parse exactly who did what when, because it's all forwarding the work of the legislature. Is there a different purpose for using Rule 12-1?
No, Your Honor, I think that's precisely the purpose, that they're all working in pre-enactment services under the confidentiality statute, that is enveloped by those that statute, and everyone's working together. It's a legislative council service, the staff on the Appropriation and Finance Committee in the House. So they are working together to create what is the final bill. But we have no way of knowing. Now, this is a good pivot to the district court's order, because in paragraph 4 and paragraph 9 of that order, the district court said they just want the final spreadsheet and indication as enacted. Well, if we had that, we'd give it to them. That'd be an easy call. That's a public document. If we had the information which actually identified the particular legislator and the amount of funding, we'd hand it over. That's simple. We don't have that. And as Ms. Chavez-Romero
said, well, you didn't have that at the time. You do now.
We do now. And we do now. We're going to address that, Your Honor. The importance of that, because that's a crucial legal question for this court to consider, which is the prospective application of statutes and rules under the Uniform Statute and Rules Construction Act. That's a crucial piece of our claim of an abuse.
But I derailed you from the order. I apologize.
No, that's no problem, Your Honor. That's a very good question. I appreciate the question. So if we could try to reverse engineer and create a new document, but it wouldn't be accurate because we don't know.
Counsel, paragraph 4, I'm looking at her order now. Isn't it really just asking for the disclosure of the spreadsheet, which may be useful in answering the ultimate question, but it's not a one-for-one. I mean, she's saying, give the preliminary spreadsheet because it helps New Mexico Ethics Watch to answer the question of which legislators might have been responsible for final enactments.
Your Honor, that's the operative term in your question, I believe, is might. We don't know. And secondly, that is by definition a pre-enactment request for service, which the legislature has deemed to be confidential under the confidentiality statute. So we don't have, and when that did change, we found a mechanism to do that, but we didn't have that in 2021. So we are left with pre-enactment documents, only pre-enactment documents that the district court has required that we produce prior to the enactment of legislation,
I don't disagree with some of what you just said, but I think Judge Houghton's point is that in the briefing, there's a great deal of concern that you are going to be required to create a document that at that time did not exist. And it looks like in paragraph 4, even though it says as enacted at the end of it, what the court was trying to require was the pre-enactment document that will allow, and that's in the words of paragraph 4, plaintiff to sort of reconstruct what happened at the end. So the judge wasn't requiring you to create a new document so much as letting Ethics Watch use the pre-decision document to construct what happened later.
The use of the pre-enactment, and I'll say this is not in the records, so I need to be very careful. I've seen these things, okay? Mm-hmm. These spreadsheets, and they're a mess. But the pre-enactment document is the point of this appeal. That is hands off. It cannot, that is an interference with a deliberative legislative process. If there's a methodology to determine who appropriated what and how much in the chapter legislation, that is what should be produced. There is no methodology in 2021.
Counsel, I want to interrupt. I want to make sure we have enough time to discuss.
Yeah.
I think what you're relying on, at least one of the pieces that you're relying on to say this is off limits. I'm looking at section 2313, I believe it is, request for service, right? And so your argument seems to be premised on the fact that the spreadsheet, the creation of the spreadsheet is a request for service. In support, so brief in chief 29, you cite Mr. Burciaga's second affidavit where he lists out a number of IPRA requests that were denied as proof of what a request for service is. I'm not finding that terribly helpful. We're here to construct a statute. So what do you propose this court looks at to construe Section 2313 and what a request for service is?
Your Honor, the request for service covers a broad array of activity that legislators rely on for the Legislative Council Service to accomplish, to determine whether they are going to go forward with particular legislation. They can ask for drafts of particular legislation they will never introduce. They can ask for research on a variety of projects. They can create requests for appropriation in various areas. And each time, they need to come to the Legislative Council Service with security.
Right. So, counsel, I understand your argument. The plaintiff's counsel cites Section 238 as perhaps something we should look at in construing what a request for service is. What should we look at, either in case law, statute, et cetera, not an affidavit? What should we look at to define what a request for service is? Or are you stating that anything that goes on in LCS or the legislature, short of a bill that's introduced on the floor, is a request for service?
The latter, Your Honor, and I think it's very important. I want to be very clear in what I'm saying. To preserve the integrity of the legislative process, any pre-enactment activity has to be protected from disclosure, all pre-enactment activities. So if it's an oral request, it's a written request, request for research, a legislator wants to see how a particular bill might look that he or she has made no commitment to introduce, they can do that. They generate those all the time. But under the district court's order, any request for service, a legislator walking into the Legislative Council Service, making a request for service for a pre-enactment activity to determine whether he or she is going to sponsor a bill or what he or she is going to do, is now subject to disclosure, outside interference on the legislative process. They can get that information. This is a chilling effect on the independence of the legislative branch. And I might add, Your Honor, that's a good pivot to the Stewart case, because in that case, the legislative activity was probably more tenuous. It dealt with administrative matters, seating in the floor, office assignments. And Justice Thompson, speaking for the court, said, we're not getting into what the legislative activity is. It's a protected activity. And this is a protected activity until such time as the bill is enacted and the legislature has made a determination who is going to be disclosed in that enactment, which has happened.
And now, I have a question about that last point. So if you look at the district court's order, paragraph 8, the last part of that paragraph, she says it's standard procedure of the staff of the legislative committees, including the House Appropriations and Finance Committee, to direct members of LCS to keep all requests for appropriations, laws, memorials, bills, other services confidential until presented in committee or on the floor. Is that accurate? Is what she's saying that once a bill is enacted, everything that went into the machine, LCS, pre-enactment, gets disclosed? Or is
no,
that inaccurate?
She is not accurate, Your Honor. And I think it's what I would point out, I think that's really important for the court to look at, is a good segue to your question, Judge Houghton. Paragraph 15. She pivoted to the pre-enactment activities directly and said, once compilation is drafted into a bill, I believe she's talking about the spreadsheet, it is submitted to the Finance Committee to be adopted. That's demonstrably incorrect. The draft spreadsheet is submitted to the committee, but not to be adopted. It's submitted to the committee for debate and determination as to what they're going to do. It's then submitted to the floor for debate. It's changed on the floor. It's changed by leadership. So all we are left with is pre-enactment activities. And to answer Judge Altrup's earlier question, yes, any pre-enactment activity by a legislator is confidential. It has to remain confidential because that is integral to the legislative process.
So counsel, what are you basing that on? Is it the speech and debate clause? Is it the any request for service? Because any request for service seems to be linguistically narrower than what you just stated.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't believe it is. I believe it's in practice and in the language is quite broad. My answer to the question, though, directly, Your Honor, is I think the court wants to avoid a constitutional question if possible. So I do think the confidentiality statute clearly makes this order invalid and should be reversed. However, the same considerations are present with the speech and debate clause. And I think that's one of the problems with Ethics Watch has made a lot in their briefs about, well, we'll parse this particular request for service. And Judge Autrop, I think you're making that reference. This is not a request for service. This is. I think the Stewart case is very clear that we don't inquire into that, that we should not inquire into that, because it is a legislative activity, and that is within the province of the legislative branch. It's not within the province of the judiciary to interfere with that. It's not within the province of the executive to interfere with that. So with all due respect, those pre-enactment activities are protected under the statute, which is the first place, but they are also protected under our Supreme Court's interpretation of the speech and debate clause. And
so,
that,
counsel, if we're just construing the statute and we see contents and nature of request for service, and we're going to construe that in its plain meaning and not say that it's any communication at all from the legislators to the legislative council service. Let's say we take that approach. If these spreadsheets were prepared by the committees before a request for service was ever sent to the legislative council service, are they protected in that moment by the statute?
Yes, they still are, Your Honor, because the statute is interpreted broadly to cover all aspects of the legislative process, regardless of who does them. But the fact is, in this case...
it doesn't say that anywhere in the statute. I mean, you're asking us to put words into the statute that aren't there.
I am not asking that at all, Your Honor. I'm asking the court to focus on what the legislative activity is pre-enactment, that it is a legislative council service and the staff of the various committees. And that statute has been applied to all staff members who assist the legislative council.
I'm sorry, counsel, who is applying that statute? Who are you referring to right now?
The legislative council service, traditionally, as always, and the legislature has always applied, always looked at the confidentiality statute very strictly. And
right, but we're here as the court construing the statute. So
correct.
Other than this is how LCS and the legislature has always done it, to Judge Houghton's point, what can the court utilize to construe the language of the statute as broadly as you're suggesting it should be construed?
I think, Your Honor, that the court has to focus on what is the nature of the act. Is the nature of the act legislation, and is it pre-enactment? If it's pre-enactment, it's covered by the confidentiality statute. Is a legislative council service doing something in response to a request for service to render that statute operative in that circumstance? My answer to you is unequivocally, yes, it is. And here, another thing, Your Honor, I think that this is a good pivot for that. And I think it's important that we get to this point. It's what happened after 2021. What happened in 2022 is very interesting. The legislature said, let's find a way. Let's find a way to make sure we can disclose each legislator who made the appropriation and the amount of the appropriation in the chapter of legislation. We don't know how that's going to work because there's a lot of give and take in this process. There's a lot of sausage making. It's a lot of politics, as the court knows. We don't know how that's going to work, so let's make it temporary. We know it's temporary because in 2022 it wasn't codified in the New Mexico statutes. It wasn't codified at all. And it had prospective application. And under the Uniform Statute and Rules Construction Act, we construe statutes prospectively unless the statute specifically says otherwise. The district court didn't even consider that act. So we know this is prospective only because in 2022 it said, let's do it for this act, the names and the amounts in this act. Now here's the part that causes me, I'm perplexed over, frankly. And it's a little bit disheartening. The act in 2022 said, notwithstanding section 2-3-13, we're going to do this. That's an acknowledgement by the legislature that 2-3-13 would otherwise make the information confidential that preceded the enactment of the statute. And the district court took that phrase, and instead of ascribing the ordinary meaning, she said, well, I'm going to say that means that 2-3-13 has never been interpreted to be applied this way. It's never ascribed confidentiality to the actions of the legislature, when in fact, when the language notwithstanding the statute means the exact opposite. So here we have a temporary prospective act going forward. In 2023, they determined it worked pretty well. So they said, let's make it permanent. Let's make sure that all the legislators and the amounts of the appropriations are disclosed in the chapter of legislation. And they did. But that's prospective as well, because that says after January 17, 2023. So the district court's order does not even consider the Uniform Statute and Rules Construction Act, which requires prospective application. In 2022, it wasn't certain how it was going to work, so they tried. That's their prerogative. Totally a legislative prerogative to make that retroactive or make it prospective. They made it prospective. That's not for us. It's not, with all due respect, it's not for the court. That's for an equal branch of government within their province of constitutional duties to enact laws. And that's exactly what they did.
Counsel, I think you're to the part of your argument where you're talking about the district court's reasoning, and I was confused by something you said at the outset, which was that we're to apply an abuse of discretion standard to what the district court did in the way that you just described, which confuses me. What case can we rely on to apply an abuse of discretion standard to what seems to me to be statutory construction?
Yes, and contrary to law, too, Your Honor. We brief that quite fully, that is on the failure to apply the Uniform Statute and Rules Construction Act to this case. Didn't even mention it. Just kicked it to the curb. So we have no application of that whatsoever. And that she used the 2022 Act and the 2023 Act as justification for saying produce what was not disclosed pre-enactment in 2021. That's an abuse of discretion. That's contrary to law because it does not respect the Uniform Statute and Rules Construction Act, providing for prospective application only. And that's the problem. So that's how she got there.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time is up. We'll hear from you again.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Yohallam, and I represent New Mexico Ethics Watch. In 2021, New Mexico Ethics Watch, which is a government watchdog organization, became concerned that some legislators might be sponsoring appropriations for entities which then hired these legislators to provide contract services for pay. Ethics Watch obtained public records from the Secretary of State's office showing which legislators were receiving payment from which organizations. The next step was to determine whether those legislators were sponsoring appropriations for those organizations. Therefore, we asked the legislature and the Legislative Counsel Service, which is the records custodian for the legislature, to provide documents about legislators' requests for appropriations under three bills: the Appropriations Act, the General Appropriations Act, HB2, HB 285, which is the Capital Projects Appropriations Act, and HB2 Junior, the Supplemental Appropriations Act of 2021. When defendants failed to provide records under those acts, we filed this lawsuit. But early in the lawsuit, we learned that, in fact, there was no tracking of individual requests for the General Appropriations Act, HB2, and the statewide capital projects designations. Let me just a little footnote here. The legislature had, just as this lawsuit, I guess it was in 2021, had passed a law that said that the capital outlay had to have, that they had to produce a document that showed which legislator asked for which capital outlay. So that had already happened. There was a piece of it that was oblique, or obscure, something called the statewide designation. And we asked specifically for who were the legislators involved in the statewide designation, because we already had it for everything else. And that was what our request was. We learned early on that there were no documents that would identify legislators with HB2 appropriations or the statewide capital. That left us with our request concerning HB2 Junior, the Supplemental Appropriations Bill for 2021. That is the only issue before the court. Our request was for all requests for, this is what we asked for, all requests for appropriations from House Bill 2 Junior, the Supplemental Appropriations Act, submitted to the LFC, Legislative Finance Committee, the House Appropriations and Finance Committee, HAFIC, or the Senate Finance Committee in the 2021 legislative session by individual senators and representatives. We believe that we were entitled to those records under IPRA. IPRA provides in 14-2-6G that a public body includes the legislature, so therefore the legislature has, in enacting IPRA, included itself in the production of documents, and I think excluded itself from a claim of any kind of privilege concerning those documents.
Counsel, I understand that New Mexico Ethics Watch wanted to connect these dots, that, you know, the legislators request for appropriations could be connected to payments that would show corruption, right? So why, and maybe you didn't, but did New Mexico Ethics Watch let go of any of the requests that were preliminary that didn't make it into the final junior bill?
So we don't have the document that you're talking about.
But let's assume, I think we're all assuming that this preliminary spreadsheet exists.
Yes,
that shows, that connects legislators with their requests for appropriations.
Right.
It seems to me you wanted the whole list because that would tell you whether somebody is trying to corruptly get some money for an entity that has given them a kickback.
That is correct.
Right? So why would you let go of the requests that didn't make it into the final bill?
We're not letting go of that. I mean, what the request doesn't say that made it into the final bill. That was something that we raised in response to the defendant's position and argument. Their argument was, if it didn't make it into the final bill, then maybe this is a preliminary matter. And our position was, well, if you give us this and you want to redact it because you're going to claim it's confidential, you can go ahead and do that. And we will then determine whether we want to fight about exactly the point you're making. But so, that never happened.
But the district court judge, seems to me, ordered the production of the preliminary spreadsheet and gave the option to the legislature to carve out anything that didn't make it into the final bill.
She did give them the option to redact under another provision under IPRA.
And we're not happy with that
at this point, because the legislature has enacted something that requires production of the very documents we're after for 22 and subsequent years.
Well, not entirely, because you're after anything that legislators are requesting, not necessarily what makes it into the final bill. What you're after is corruption.
Yes.
And it doesn't necessarily, you don't need the final bill to show that. You need to know is what legislators are requesting.
I respectfully think, Your Honor, if it didn't make it into the final bill, I'm not sure we can show corruption. Maybe they asked for it. Maybe they changed their mind. We don't know. There's an important difference here, however, that we're assuming that there was a lot of process that went on to these spreadsheets and things got excluded and all the rest. That's not true. And despite what opposing counsel have said, in my opinion, the only person who actually talked about the process for this bill was David Abbey, the longtime director of the Legislative Finance Committee. And Mr. Abbey said, when asked, you know, is there work done on these spreadsheets? And he said, very little time is devoted to that. And the reason is because members get what they want. Our role isn't to suggest they change their stuff. And he said that his understanding is that basically, once the spreadsheets are compiled based on the individual requests from the legislators, then all that happens is they are discussed in committee, which is open to the public, and then they go to legislative service to be reflected in bill format.
So and what you're outlining, counsel, is a factual dispute between you and the legislature. It seems that the legislature believes that the records support the idea that there is a back and forth, there's a deliberation. And it seems like your position, based on Abby's deposition, is that there's not, that it's really formulaic.
The record doesn't show that, Your Honor.
But isn't that a factual dispute?
No.
And what are we to do with
court
that?
The district court has resolved that issue and has determined that Abbey was describing that process. And the other, there was nothing in Burciaga's affidavits to suggest otherwise. And the other affidavit came in 2 years later, and it didn't say anything about the specific process of that year. And I think the district court properly found substantial evidence in the record to make the conclusion that she did, which is that this process was the way David Abbey described it, and there was actually nothing done. So the idea that there's all this change that happens to these spreadsheets is something that is just argument by counsel. They didn't get anything in the record to substantiate that.
But even if it operates the way that you suggest, that the committees take the forms, they prepare the spreadsheet, pass it off to LCS for LCS to draft the bills, isn't that enough? Isn't it enough to be a request for service?
No.
If the spreadsheet goes from the committee to LCS to do its job under the other provision, 238?
So individual, this is what 238 says, that it's request for by individual legislators for research or for converting something into a bill. That's not what this is. The legislators are told by, and Abby's deposition explicitly lays this out, legislators are told how much money they have to spend, and they are at their complete discretion to say how they want to spend it. And
they fill out the form and make a request that goes to the committees.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a request.
Not to LCS, though.
But it's combined. I mean, is it an administrative function? Does the creation of the spreadsheet get so much in between the individual legislator and LCS that it's not a request for service anymore?
Yeah, I don't think it's a request by an individual legislator at all. The legislator has said to the committee, this is what I want to do with my money, the money you've allocated to me. And it's a pro forma. It's not like a legislator is saying to the legislative council service, I have this idea for this piece of legislation, I want to work on it with you, and then they do that. That needs to be protected, because the legislator might decide that this is not a good idea. The legislator might decide, I don't want to submit this bill. That's not what's happening here. The legislator has made its request. Each of them has made this request. It's reflected in the spreadsheet. And it's a pro forma act. It's not a request for service that goes to the legislative council service. And the idea that the other side is offering, which is that everything pre-enactment is confidential, is nonsense. I mean, committee meetings are open to the public. You hear what legislators in those committee meetings say about their own desire for changes in the legislation. Sponsorship of a bill is public. There's many, many parts of the pre-enactment process that are open to the public by the legislature. And clearly the legislature thought the public should have access to these kinds of records because, number one, before our suit was filed, they had independently made that judgment concerning the confidentiality, concerning the capital outlay legislation. And as a result of our my view is, as a result of our lawsuit filed in December of 2021, in the February 2022 session, the legislature then changed established that what we were looking for was legitimate.
I think I don't quite understand. So under 238C, one of the purposes of the LCS is to furnish the members of the legislature of this state the assistance of expert draftsmen. So the idea is LCS provides a drafting service, and that a request to LCS for drafting, which it would appear is what's happening between the committees, and I'll ask my question about that in a minute, between the committees and LCS is a request for service. So is the fact that it's coming from a committee and not from an individual member the distinction that you're making in subsection C?
I think it's two things, Your Honor. I think, number one, the fact that it's not coming from an individual legislator, and the language of the section you're talking about talks about legislators.
Members of the legislature.
Correct. So I think that is one point. But a second point is that we have to look at that statute in terms of what are they getting at here? And I think that what they're getting at is the deliberative process between a legislator and the embodiment of an idea in legislation. And that's not what's happening here.
But they are turning it into a bill.
Well, that's a pro forma act that is not where they are taking a legislator's idea about a bill, reflecting it in legislative language, and then the legislator gets to look at it and decide, well, do I really want to introduce this? Is this how it will work? I may want to run this by some constituents. And we want the legislators to have that kind of independence of thought. This is a different process. And in fact, the legislature itself has recognized it's a different process by requiring it for the capital bill and now requiring it for subsequent supplemental appropriations.
Both parties here seem to want us to incorporate aspects of deliberative process or analysis into the statutory analysis. All 2313 says is a request or statement for service. And then if we look at 238, it says one of the services or the purposes, one of the duties provided or performed by LCS is as a draftsperson. So if we exclude the underpinnings of privilege and the constitutional aspect of what the legislature does, and we just look at these two statutes, how do we exclude drafting?
Well, I think you have to look at the context in that statute. And
the factual record.
Yes. That statute, 238, talks about research, talks about requests for service from individuals. And I think it's just understanding the legislative process to see what they're talking about there. They want to make sure that they can have a confidential relationship as the lawyers and analysts for the legislature between them and individual legislators. That's what that section is about. And I think that it doesn't include something like this, where the committee is taking a spreadsheet and sending it over to the Legislative Counsel Service and saying, just put this in a bill. I think it's a very different situation than what is contemplated by all of those sections of 238.
So in your view, do we construe request or statement for service together with 238, evaluate what it is that's actually happening in every IPRA for in every document requested under IPRA, get to the nuts and bolts of the legislative process within these committees and between committees members and LCS, and based on all of that, decide whether it's a request for service every time?
You won't have to do that because the legislature has decided that these documents are to be made public from now on.
The post-enactment.
Yes, subsequently.
Well, at least in this context.
Let me just point out, we have never argued there's a retroactive application of those. We and the district court judge in her motion rejecting, in her order rejecting rehearing, is very clear that what she's talking about is simply that we can learn something from what the legislature subsequently did about their own views. And what they were doing and saying, notwithstanding 2313, is rejecting the defendant's arguments, which they knew had been made in this situation. And so that's all that's going on there. And we think that the legislature, by recognizing that it wants to produce these documents going forward, is telling the Legislative Counsel Service that the argument it's making in this case has been rejected by the legislature. And they've decided that, in fact, notwithstanding any argument that could be made about privilege or about the confidentiality statute, that these documents are to be made public. And I think that it's a gloss on what happened the year before.
If we construe the statute to mean that request for service means request for service, we don't get into the business of figuring out how involved the request for service is. We just say it's a request for service. Is there a way to distinguish between the legislators giving their piece of paper to the committee and the committee compiling the spreadsheet,
yes,
which happens at time A, and time B, which is then the spreadsheet gets put into an email sent to LCS and they say, can you prepare the junior appropriation bill based on
yes,
this spreadsheet?
I agree. And I think that clearly the legislators request pieces of paper. They're not requests, they're directives. They tell the committee exactly what they want to do with the amount that's been allocated to them. That's not a request for service. That is a factual conveyance of information from a legislator to the committee. And the committee then, if they want to produce the pieces of paper for us, if they exist, that's fine. David Abbey testified that the way Ethics Watch could determine who requested which appropriation could be done either by the pieces of paper by which these requests are submitted to the committee or by the compilation made by the committee, either of those two things. And I think it's quite clear that the compilation still exists. Mr. Abbey said he'd seen it, but as to the pieces of paper, we don't know what happened to those.
And if we did construe it that way, what would you say about the speech and debate clause covering the submission of pieces of paper, which are just requests from legislators?
Yes, I think it's quite clear that the speech or debate clause and Stewart versus Ramczyk have absolutely nothing to do with this case. First of all, the court explicitly said in paragraph 15 that its decision was explicitly limited to the facts of that case and rejected any subsequent delving into the more complex and controversial areas of immunity. So the court didn't do that. And the court admonished everybody in Stewart versus Ramczyk, don't take this out of context. Second of all, that case, that case dealt with a lawsuit for damages by one senator to another. It's exactly in the area that is covered by speech or debate. The speech or debate clause arose out of an attempt to protect people in the legislature from an overbearing executive or judicial branch. And what the speech or debate clause says is that no one can be arrested as a result of their attendance at sessions. And then the crucial sentence is the last one, which says, and they shall not be questioned in any other place for any speech or debate or for any vote cast in either house. This case does not question any legislator about speech or debate or the vote that they cast. The defendants in this case are not individual legislators. The case does not challenge or hold to account any legislative act. It merely seeks to identify each legislator's appropriation from the supplemental appropriations bill. The case furthers transparency and does not impede any legislative action. By including the legislature in IPRA, I believe the New Mexico legislature itself determined that transparency on these issues, not secrecy, were essential to the legislative process. And I believe that it expressly waived any possible application of legislative immunity to IPRA requests.
Is there an express waiver of any sort of privilege?
Excuse me?
Is there any express waiver of privilege? Did the legislature expressly waive any privilege that might exist?
No, it is by implication. And I think that we have to understand that with the time that the legislature enacted IPRA and included itself, it knew that there was something called legislative immunity out there. There was a speech or debate clause that preceded that piece of legislation. And it makes clear that it is covered by this. And it has not accepted itself in any way. It did not add a phrase subject to legislative immunity. There's nothing like that in the statute.
No, but it did.
But counsel, it did provide as otherwise provided by law, which
yes,
is the subsection of IPRA that we're all talking about. So
sure,
how is it that provision in IPRA didn't as otherwise provide for law if there is some sort of legislative protection that existed at the time?
I think that there are certainly something like attorney-client privilege would have been covered by otherwise provided by law. But a broad concept that, as opposing counsel suggests, that everything that happens, all documents created before the final enactment are confidential, are protected under this speech or debate clause, is anathema to the idea that they included themselves. If they meant to exclude themselves from all IPRA requests, then why did they put themselves into IPRA at all? And I think that we have to be reasonable in the way we look at these statutes. And if knowing that there was a speech or debate clause and that everything prior to enactment could be protected, and they didn't do that, and instead they put themselves into IPRA.
So counsel, then, is the Republican Party case incorrect in that I don't believe IPRA explicitly identified executive privilege, but our Supreme Court has stated that certain aspects of executive privilege survive IPRA. What you're saying is the legislature had to explicitly exempt certain privileges or exceptions as otherwise provided by law isn't enough.
No, I think that we just have to be reasonable in looking at if they put themselves in to the statute, they certainly didn't mean to then exclude themselves from every request under IPRA. And that's really what the other side's argument is, that if these things are exempt, then everything is protected. And we can't open the curtain and look at what's happening in the legislative process. And that is anathema to Republican Party. Republican Party says that the default of IPRA is production of documents and transparency, and every exception is to be read very narrowly. And that means the otherwise provided by law has to be read very narrowly. And here, the argument the other side is making is that all of this is secret, and that can't be. And I think the legislature understood that by including itself in IPRA. And yes, there may be some specific things that are excluded under the otherwise provided by law, but the general application of legislative immunity can't be one of those. On the other hand, let me also say that where you had a case like the Candelaria versus, it was Stewart versus Ramsick, but it was Senator Candelaria who was basically complaining about Senator Stewart's treatment of him. And there he filed a Human Rights Act complaint in the court seeking damages there that directly implicates the speech or debate clause and the protections from that as the court delineated. That's not the case here. There's no suit for damages against any individual legislator. And besides, let me also point out, the immunity is to individual legislators, not to the legislature as a whole. And so what we have here is no suit against an individual legislator. It's just against the legislature and the custodian. And we're not seeking damages, and we're not challenging or trying to hold to account any legislative act in our request for documents. It is simply a request for information, for documents. And it's not covered by the one case we have in New Mexico, the Stewart versus Ramsick case, but it's also not covered by any federal case that's included. And indeed, in a case that we cited, Cruz versus Guzman versus State, it's actually cited in the Stewart versus Ramsick decision. They say we declined to interpret one provision of the Constitution, the speech or debate clause, to immunize the legislature from meeting its obligations under more specific constitutional provisions, the education, equal protection, and due process clauses. And that's a case out of Minnesota. But
here we don't have competing constitutional provisions. We have speech and debate constitutional provision versus a statute, IPRA, right?
Right.
Okay.
But they need to be read together.
And just so I'm clear about your suggested construction of 2313, you would have us read it in light of IPRA's general purpose, that it's defaults disclosure, public access to public records. You would have us read it narrowly in two ways. One, that it only applies when individual legislators are making a request for service. And two, it only applies if that request for service is of a deliberative nature.
Yes.
Okay.
Defendants also attacked the attorney's fees that were awarded by the court. And number one, they say that we didn't succeed in this case, but as the court itself has determined in American Civil Liberties Union versus Duran, any success and any success, an order that requires the provision, the production of any documents constitutes success is the case here, where we have had a court order which required production of these documents. In addition, the defendants argue that the amount of fees are not reasonable. Defendants did not dispute the hourly rate requested by plaintiff's attorneys or the reasonableness of the hours actually reported for each task. What they say is that they should get to exclude some of our work because it involved other provisions that were not subject to the court's order. But as we've explained to the court, we sought production of appropriation requests by individual legislators from three different bills. When we learned that there were no documents responsive to two of those, we immediately dropped that aspect from the case. That happened very early on. And all the legal research and all the work that went into the pre-filing, the drafting of the complaint, and the Abby deposition, it was all the same. It was the same arguments about IPRA's applicability and the necessity to provide these documents. The fact that it was from one bill or another didn't change the amount of work or the nature of the work that was done. And the judge properly found that all of our work on this case was inextricably intertwined with the work on which we succeeded. And so there's no basis for apportionment of the success that we achieved in this case in terms of the amount of fees. And we think that, again, it's we don't think the judge abused any discretion in making the award that she did for attorney's fees. I'm happy to answer any other questions the court might have before my 24 seconds are left. Thank you.
I don't think I can ask a question that you can answer in that amount of time. But thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Your Honor, I want to make very clear, disabusing any notion today that these requests are somehow static and that they are, it's an administrative process only. It's not. And our affidavits establish that, the record establishes that very clearly, that these are living documents that precede the enactment of the statute.
Is there a factual dispute here, as Judge Houghton discussed with opposing counsel? I mean, the deposition and the affidavits do not seem to align. The district court considered the affidavits, but how it's not. Is it our job to reconcile these facts?
It is not, Your Honor. Thank you for that question, because it is not the appellate court's job to do that. But there is no rebuttal of the affidavits explaining how the process lives through that document. Mr. Abbey testified correctly that, yes, as a legislator, you go to the committee, this is what I want. The committee's not necessarily going to disturb that request, but it changes over time. So Mr. Abbey didn't fill in the blanks. The blanks are filled in by Ms. Chavez-Romero and Mr. Berciaga, stating that these documents change, and they do change. And, Your Honor, the point is, we couldn't, if the court sent us back to create the enactment, you tell us, I want you to go back and do it. Who requested the appropriation as enacted, and how much? We couldn't do it. We couldn't do it and represent to the court that it would be anywhere near reliable. It's not possible. So that is the problem with this. It is a fluid request that works its way through the process as a request for service. And I'm mystified by this notion that the notwithstanding section 2-3-13 language somehow indicates that the legislature knew it didn't apply. That's a carve-out, clear carve-out from 2-3-13, saying that it would apply but for this legislation, which we're going to apply prospectively and temporarily to see how it goes.
But that's a dispute about interpreting legislative intent based on subsequent enactments. And so we can look to a subsequent enactment in order to discern intent before, and you can disagree about what that might mean. And that's what seems to be happening here, not so much a prospective application.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that. I think the court has to apply the plain language of notwithstanding section 2-3-13.
When we use a subsequent enactment to discern prior legislative intent. Yes.
It doesn't apply to prior legislative enactment.
It doesn't tell us anything about what the old statute meant?
No. But it told you that the new statute would only be applied prospectively. It told you that. And that this would be a limited carve-out to see on a temporary basis, which subsequently was made permanent in 2023. So
So we have requests or statements for services. How the identities, I'm imagining a spreadsheet, and I understand it's more complicated than a spreadsheet at this point, I think, but how is the identity of the requester part of the request or statement for service? So why couldn't the spreadsheet be redacted? But if it were to be redacted, is the identity, the person who made the request, confidential under 2313?
It is, Your Honor, confidential. And I think by Your Honor's question of asking us, could we redact, that is really is an acknowledgement of the intrusion into the legislative process, which we can't have happening. Now, the reason why, if we had this information, it would be produced. The reason why this is so important to the legislature is because it opens the floodgates. Because now you're looking at any pre-enactment request for service, the identity or the nature or contents of requests for services would be disclosed. There's no reason under this district court's order that it would not. There's no basis to hold it back. This idea that we can go through and say, so that applies to some legislative activity and not others, well, that the Stewart case debunked that notion. And I don't think it's a question of damages being sought. I think the question that the Supreme Court answered is, what's a legislative activity? Judge Ramczyk said, I got to find out. I want testimony. And the Supreme Court said, no, you don't. We're not going there. It's a legislative activity. It's not for the judicial system to make that determination. We're going to let the legislature as an independent branch of government make that determination. So we're respectfully asking the court, and I don't think this is a heavy lift, to reverse the district court's order. Because that 2021 Supplemental Appropriations Act, everything that preceded it in those draft spreadsheets is a request for service, and it should not be produced. And if we make it produced, it's going to do severe damage to the independence of the first branch of government, which is the legislature in our state.
All right.
Go ahead.
It looks like we're out of time. Quick question?
No.
Okay. All right, counsel, thank you so much for your arguments today.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Quite helpful. We're going to take this matter under advisement, and we will issue a decision just as soon as we can. Thank you again. Safe travels.
Thank you.
And we're in recess. Thank you.